Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Sargon. Sarah, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I feel like I haven't sort of been in threesome for a long time.
Yes, indeed. You have been only on the Daily Friend Wrap for a while. So good to have you back. And we are also joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
Well, continuing the racy direction of talk, I'm trying a different position.
Good man.
So before I start, let us just very quickly once again talk about the Pledge to Vote campaign. This is a campaign being run by the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR, to ensure that everyone, every South African can get out there and vote. Please go to pledgetovote.co.za to find out more and help make your voice heard in the next national election. Okay, speaking of the national election, let us move on to a fascinating poll from the Brenthurst Foundation that came out over the weekend. And this poll shows two interesting things, which can be summarized as the DA and the MK party seem to be doing relatively well, and the ANC and the IFP seem to be in some trouble. So the poll was of, I think, 1,506 people weighted based on gender, age, province, and race and all those kind of things. So thinking ahead to the next general election, which party will you vote for? The ANC is polling here at 39%, which is quite low. Reminder that in the last national election, they got 56% of the vote. This is definitely on the lower end of their polling results. The DA up to 27%. The last election, they got about 20%. The MK party, another poll. We saw one when the MK party was announced. We saw one, I think, about 2 weeks ago, which had them on about 5% nationally. This one had them on 13% nationally. The EFF on 10% and the IFP on 2%, with all the other parties making up the remaining 5%. So that's quite an interesting sort of headline. But when you look into the provinces in particular, there's more interesting results. One is that the ANC in Gauteng is polling at 34%, according to this poll, with the DA only 2% behind at 32%, the EFF on 11%, the MK party doing surprisingly well in Gauteng with 6%, Action SA on 5%, and Build One South Africa on 5%. Now, that's the first poll I've seen of Build One South Africa kind of registering at all. I'd be curious to know whether that is just a fluke or whether that is actually a continuing trend. It's always worth remembering that especially when you get to the smaller parties and also you get to the more granular survey results, that they tend to be a little bit less accurate. So I would not be surprised if there's a bit of inaccuracy here on this one, particularly when it comes to the smaller parties. They could be anything from half as much as that to twice as much as that. We won't really know. KZN is another interesting one, with this poll putting the MK party as being the largest in the province with 25% of the vote, the ANC on 20%, the DA on 19%, the IFP also on about 19%, with the EFF on 14%. That would be an absolutely devastating result for the ANC in the province. The Western Cape, the DA, maintaining 53% of the vote, according to this poll. Now, I think there's all the sort of usual caveats about polls. Polls are not a final predictor of exactly how the election is going to be. It's also difficult always to model turnout, so that can sometimes lead to errors. But assuming that this is at least in the ballpark of how things are, Terence, let me start with you. What do you make of these polling results? Once again, it looks like the ANC is in trouble, but I'm quite surprised that the MK party seems to continue to be growing its visibility in the polls.
Look, my sense of it. Okay, first of all, I think all caveats need to be observed. I think their sample was about 1,600 people, which is a fair size. I think your margin of error is sort of 2 to 3%. But as you start to work that down to smaller subcategories, that becomes sort of, you know, less and less reliable. But nevertheless, I think you can take this as a reasonably indicative snapshot. I'm no longer particularly surprised about the relative success of the MK party. My sense of it was that if it didn't have immediate traction, it would probably, you know, linger and die. And one, you know, of course, one never knows until the actual votes are cast. But since there does seem to be some evidence that that it does have a fairly solid constituency, I think this is all fairly coherent and explicable in terms of the fact that Jacob Zuma is within a particular constituency, a very relatable and popular figure. I think that political analysis often suffers from a kind of present tense bias. Zuma was so dreadful, and you know, he was crooked, and there was state capture and that sort of thing. And this sort of explains, you know, where the ANC has gone. But it should be remembered that back in, you know, when he displaced Thabo Mbeki, he was an extremely popular figure. Many of those people who would go on to rail against what his administration came to represent were very much on side with him. This was the guy who, in a sense, you know, Brian Pottinger referred to him as representing ANC classic. There was something profoundly human about him. It may have shocked the leader writers of the Mail and Guardian that he had sex with a woman who was so much younger and didn't use a condom and then went and showered. I think for a lot of people for whom, you know, Zuma was the guy, that was, you know, just something, that was a very human reaction. That he didn't use big words and he didn't talk about Beethoven. These are not things that his constituency would be particularly interested in. And, you know, those who felt aggrieved at the fact that he was an open polygamist with a brood of 20-odd children, well, you know, within a particular cultural framework, that there was nothing wrong with that. And I think, you know, you could certainly make an argument that there was something more honest about that than, you know, sneaking around with the couple of kept women, you know, while pretending to be the soul of Midwest family values. So yes, you know, he speaks to something. And I think that, you know, rather than denouncing that, it would be our time would be better spent trying to understand exactly what that is, because I think for South Africa's democratic future, it's probably nothing positive.
So let's look a little bit more into the favorability question of various political leaders and parties. I'm going to start off here by just talking about the favorability ratings of different leaders of parties. So Cyril Ramaphosa remains the person with the highest approval rating in the country. He's got 45% approval rating, which is way, way down from where it used to be. It used to be closer to 65%. It's now cratered. Jacob Zuma, second, with about 30% favorability. Julius Malema, 25%. Helen Ziller, just below Julius at 25%. Musi Maimane at 20%. John Steenhuisen, 19%. Herman Mashaba, 13%. Peter Kroonewald of the Freedom Front, plus 8%. The leader of the IFP at 5%. And Songezo Zibi at 1%. Now, what's interesting about this is when they ask favorability ratings, they don't just ask whether you have a favorable opinion. They also ask if you have an unfavorable opinion. And even though Zuma has 30% favorability, he also has 60% unfavorability, in some ways making him the most hated public figure in the country. So he remains divisive in a very important way. There are, as you say, Terence, there are some people who seem to love him, but then the majority of South Africans very much reject him. So that suggests that while the MK party definitely can hold on to a very strong base of support, it's going to be lacking in expanding that to a larger constituency. But in South Africa's electoral system, maybe you don't need to expand it to too big a constituency to hold the kingmaker seat. Also unfavorable is Julius Malema, with 54% of South Africans saying they have an unfavorable opinion of him. 39% saying the same of Cyril Ramaphosa, 39% saying the same of Helen Zille, and John Steenhuisen down at 24%, with most South Africans not expressing any opinion on him. So that's quite interesting. Looking into parties' name recognition, which is also, I think, a kind of factor that plays into this, because if you don't know who someone is, it's difficult to have an opinion about them. Rise Mzansi and Build One SA still only have about a third of South Africans knowing anything about them, having name recognition about them. Whereas the MK party, which is actually, I think, newer than both of those parties, is at 84% name recognition already. Now, for comparison, the three biggest parties, the EFF, ANC, and DA, the DA is on 97% name recognition, the EFF and ANC on 99% each. One does wonder, you know, who that 1% of South Africans who don't know who the ANC is. But anyway, then, yeah, when you look at the favorability ratings of political parties, here's another interesting little detail. The DA is, for the first time, I think, probably ever in polling, experiencing the highest favorability rating if you take away the positive from the negative, the negatives from the positives, rather, which I don't think I've ever seen before in a poll. The DA had 4% net favorability, the ANC at minus 4%, and then the EFF at minus 30%. So, a lot to unpack there, but Sarah, let me start with you. What are your takeaway from all of those? It's kind of interesting to me that the DA as a political party is more popular than any of its leaders.
Well, you know, to me, in a way, that reflects the fact that there's, I suppose, a significant number of the electorate who actually look to the issues in a pragmatic way. And because of, I assume, the fact that the ANC is pretty much ruined everything that the country has to offer. So it's a move away from the in certain areas of the leader, the charisma, which I don't think is any bad thing, because it's not about the charisma. I mean, Jacob Zuma is charisma personified, and yet, you know, he sent us spiraling down and followed by his former vice president, Cyril Ramaphosa. So I think that probably reflects to some extent that, but you still have that very traditional base in KZN, as you pointed out, that would support Zuma for reasons that are probably the complete opposite. You know, very much traditionalist. I mean, from a modern point of view, and certainly as a sort of hopefully a modern woman, I mean, Zuma is just beyond the pale. I mean, he's a misogynist. He's probably, he might well be a rapist. He's had 23 children that people know about. So that, and bearing in mind that probably has less attraction to the urbanized younger South African than the older traditional rural. I mean, KZN is meant to be, KZN in the Eastern Cape are pretty much at the last, very much redoubts of ANC strength. So, I don't know. I mean, it's really like sort of untangling spaghetti, you know, if those who feel brave enough to go into the, you know, interpretation of polling results. And, but I do think, you know, one can't really get a sense of the urban, a clear sense of the urban-rural divide on a national basis. And I would be inclined to think that that the MK party may achieve some success nationally, but its significant success lies with KZN, because I think nationally the hatred for the cause of the destruction in South Africa is probably best more felt in urban South Africa than in the rural South Africa. And I say that saying, you know, not coming off much of a base.
So let's start off, let's focus in on that one. One of the questions asked was, who is responsible for the problems with South Africa? So about 80% of South Africans say that the country is going in the wrong direction, with 17% saying it's going in the right direction. When asked who hey, there's always optimists. So when asked what's responsible for the problem, 53% said ANC government of the last three decades, 11% said apartheid, 8% said the constitution, 6% said the BEE elite, and 6% said racists, 1% said the DA, and 9% either refused to answer the question or don't know. So that's quite interesting. And Terence, I'd just like your thoughts firstly on some of the things Sara was saying, but also this 53% blaming the ANC for the problems of the last three decades. That's also, you know, really difficult for the ANC to get around. They've long blamed the past, blamed the opposition for problems. But it seems like that narrative is no longer as successful.
Well, I think that you sort of have to pull this apart. I'd be very interested to see how these answers sort of line up with each other. You know, are those people who blame the ANC for South Africa's circumstance also 100% those who will vote for other parties, for instance? I don't think that you can
probably not. Assume.
No, you see, look, this is it. It is quite possible that I've said this before. Human beings have a wonderful ability to internalize contradictions. You know, even sort of recognize them. You know, you can be an every week churchgoer, but you reckon this whole resurrection thing is nonsense. You know, that sort of thing exists. And I think for a lot of people, there is a sense that the ANC, yes, it's messed up. But, you know, I do have my grant because of the ANC. But, you know, I just can't quite bring myself to, you know, to walk away. You know, how many people persist in dysfunctional relationships because they've invested a lot in them? You know, and this is emphatically not to point fingers and say anyone's stupid or anything like that. This is just, you know... A strange facet of the way people can interpret things, but then also, you know, how that may be disjoined from the way they tend to react. Is it going to be difficult for them to get around? Yes, certainly. I think that possibly the ANC's biggest existential threat is not being able to navigate that, not being able to modernize in a sense.
Just a last point of data to talk about with you, Sara. Another interesting fact here is two other questions people were asked were, should social grants be increased or end after a period for those of working age or continue at the current level? 42% then said increased, 29% said continue at the current level, and 27% said end after a period for those of working age. Then when the respondents were asked what is the best way for government to put money in people's pockets, the number one most popular answer was 40% saying making it easier to start small businesses, 25% said reducing taxes, only 20% said increasing social grants, and 12% said decreasing the cost of civil service. What do you make of this?
Those are probably two that make sense together, because I think there's a reflection, and it's borne out by our surveys, is number one, quality of life, the thing that affects quality of life most has always been unemployment. And it also supports those who say, I think correctly, that South Africans, given the space, would find a way to be employed rather than rely on the relative indignity of a lousy social grant that barely keeps you from starvation. So I think it makes sense, and it probably, if you delineated it on sort of age range, it would show some distinct results. But it's that the consistency of the understanding that unemployment is both makes you poor and really craps on your dignity is actually borne out by the result. In other words, the result is that the solution does not lie in social grants. And of course, you know, people want more social grants because they need the money, but it's not, a better government could
right. People recognize
change there.
People recognize that a social grant may be nice to have and maybe something people definitely want and want more of, but also people recognize that it is not something that is going to change their lives in a real way. Okay, let us move on to our next topic. And this is about the initiative that was launched, I think it was last year, between business and the government. More than 130 CEOs, some of them from very big companies, endorsed this initiative where government and business were going to work more closely together. They had a whole forum and a name for it, and they were going to fix all of South Africa's problems. The president, Cyril Ramaphosa, in his weekly newsletter, talked about the great successes of this program so far. He says that this has resulted in load shedding being not as severe as last year, that it's helped clear the problems with Transnet and a whole bunch of other things. He talked about the private sector contributing 170 million rand in direct support and mobilizing more than 350 technical experts. Sara, what do you make of this?
It doesn't mean anything. And until one hears from business honestly about what's going on, he doesn't say he's you know, he talks about the broad categories that business is involved in. But there are no specifics. And certainly based on the sort of man in the street poll that's sitting in this chair, load shedding is constant, but chaotic. All the so-called, whatever improvements he says they've made, I don't know what they are, because, you know, you can, the minute it comes out of your mouth, something will go boom. So, and the particularly up in Joburg and areas around, our relationship with the provision of water is becoming a far distant memory. So the representative of the business side said that they would report back regularly on what they're achieving, and frankly I have no idea what they're achieving, and Ramaphosa is not the source for that information to really understand whether this relationship is working. And if one assumes that the ANC is just incapable of crossing that ideological divide to really let in the free market, the private sector, one assumes that it's not going swimmingly. But I'm not, as I say, Ramaphosa wouldn't be my source of reliable information.
Terence, what do you make of this?
Well, I have to echo the idea that Radio Ramaphosa, yeah, must be taken with a pinch of salt. I think that I was at a workshop, this is going back about 15 years, and a very well-known economist said that in his estimation, the biggest single problem confronting South Africa is a lack of a cooperative relationship between government and business. And I think that that's correct. And what Ramaphosa is describing, even if everything he says is true, and even if it is impactful, that does not speak to the kind of relationship you actually want. Business and the state have distinct interests, and they should have distinct responsibilities. Yes, there should be cooperation, but you want to be careful of collusive dealings between the two. You also it's simply not a not a good place to be where you are relying on business to sort of step in and pull your chestnuts out of the fire. If you decide you don't want to, provide, these particular public services, then privatize them formally. Mm-hmm. But the idea, keep state control because we need a strong developmental state, yada, yada, yada. We need to sort of pursue our wonderful program of social engineering, et cetera, et cetera. And we just we need business to sort of step in and help and you know, do as they're told to sort of help us get it. There's so many internal contradictions in that. It's not so much tragic as farcical. Mm. And I think that what business has to learn, and I do have some sympathy. Business are not, they're not politicians. They are, you know, business is about making money. You know, there are certain, you know, there's a relationship between risk, investment and profit. And they're fairly rational calculations. But I think after 30 years, they should realize that this is not the way that the government of that the incumbent government of South Africa thinks. And I think further work should simply be transactional. We will assist in exchange for, and also, you know, I mean, I do think that there would be an appetite, for instance, to run South Africa's ports.
Mm.
But, you know, then it has to be a long-term one where you actually leave the company to, you know, to do its thing. If they're going to sink, you know, billions and trillions of rands.
Right. And a fair bidding process.
Precisely. When you start saying yes, but, you know, you also have to have, you know, your correct deployed cadre and your, you know, 30% BE boondoggle and, you know, there's South Africa's version of the license Raj that you'll have to go through, and you can keep this for 1 year, you know, after which the developmental state will be knocking on your door again. No, well, that's as my late mother would say, that's stupid. Mother could hiss that out.
Sara, any final thoughts on this?
I think I had exactly this thought when this thing was negotiated. I mean, there were some heavy hitters who were generally a bit of cynical and worldly wise, you know, on this sort of stuff. But my feeling at the time was the business had not demanded enough from government, enough undertakings from government about how this would run. And you knew from that moment that it wasn't going to, it probably wasn't going to run. There would be successes here and there, but, and I agree with Terence that it's a sort of political naivety. And I think there's generally been a reluctance for all the reasons that you spelled out of the way business works, to factor politics into every aspect of our lives, personal and business. Everything government does has an impact on what we do. And I think there's been naivety. And I also think that close access to government has very often, it's just too close for the, you know, wood and trees scenario to actually see what sometimes perhaps ordinary people see more clearly. And that is that, you know, the government, you've got to be very, very, you've got to be much tougher on them, particularly as theoretically they're on their knees. And that there's all the legislation waiting to be promulgated that is going to make life more difficult for the business sector. So
it's not, it's not helpful when, for example, Sanlam CEO goes and talks about how NHI will not be a complete disaster, not necessarily a complete disaster. I mean,
that's treason.
In a manner of speaking. Okay, let us move on to our next story here. We don't have a huge amount of time to cover this, but it is one of those surveys that you sort of read, and you had to read it twice because it's a bit horrifying. But anyway, so this was a survey that was looking mostly at South African opinions on the sexual violence used by Hamas in Israel on October 7th in the Hamas attack on Israel. But it did also ask some other questions which say some interesting things about South African society. So 97% of respondents agreed that rape and gender-based violence are profound problems. 90% believe that all rape victims should be supported regardless of race, culture, religion, or gender. 73% believe that rape is never justifiable. However, and this is the sort of headline, 25% say that it can sometimes be justified in wartime. Another unrelated to that kind of topic in a sense, but 56% had never heard of Hamas and 62% had not heard about the October 7th attack on Israel. And when presented some details of the attack, 79% believed that it was unjustified act of war and terror and should be prosecuted as a war crime. About 70% said that. But Terence, on that earlier figure of, you know, rape being justified in times of war, that is not a completely isolated survey response. Would you like to talk more about that?
No. Well, okay, look, historically, this is a very sad fact about warfare, that rape is often used, you know, is often seen by soldiers as a kind of spoil of war, and war can often bring out the worst in people. I mean, this was, I think, you know, during times of sieges, for instance, in the you know, into the 19th century, the idea was that if a city surrendered, it would throw itself at the mercy of the occupiers, and they would generally be treated leniently if they had surrendered. If, however, you had to go through the trauma of storming it, you were then literally placed at the mercy of the invading forces, and sometimes, you know, you'd get 3 or 4 days to do what you wanted before they would try and restore some order. You can imagine what sort of went on. So what does strike me is that that sort of proportion could hold us as an almost principled belief that it can be justified in wartime. And I would be very legitimately interested in drilling down into that. Are they saying that it is acceptable for a combatant to sort of take his reward like that, is as a means to terrorize a civilian population? I mean, these are dark questions. But interestingly, Afrobarometer has conducted research into gender-based violence. Now, these things are not the same, but, you know, it's called the same WhatsApp group. They found that about 20% of South Africans believe that it is sometimes acceptable for a man to discipline his wife physically. You know, so in other words, if you kick your wife around a bit, there's one person in five. And just think about this. You get into a minibus with 20 occupants, two of them. Four of them will think, it's not so bad. About 18% say that it's a private, not a criminal matter. I do think that this has knock-on effects. There's obviously the question of how South Africa responds to something like the 7th of October and the appalling things that took place there. But it's also, you know, there is a developmental question. I think some people might be tempted to sort of wave this away and say, well, you know, it's all politically, about political correctness. But women's security and their ability to exercise their own agency is a massive resource for a society. Now, you know, a country like India, for instance, built 1 million enclosed toilets. Why? Because while performing your toilet functions, that was often where women were attacked, and this was meant to give a sort of privacy and whatever to try and ameliorate that. And that has actually had an effect on violence against women, on sexual assault, and that sort of thing. Combined with things like education or whatever, that means more productivity. Now, this is something, protecting the female population is an investment in the population as a whole. It's very sad that between 20 and 30% of South Africans seem to see this differently.
Farah, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, let's put it this way. Zuma has proposed for the second time in 9 years that pregnant teenagers, and now he specifically referred to schoolgirls, should be put on Robben Island to get an education while they're pregnant, because they can't perform, they're not geared to be mothers at that age. And what he's really So, I mean, I would say MK is the party to represent that opinion, because he does. There's nothing in anything he says that puts any real blame on the men. So I think there is a reason why that percentage of South Africans have what I suppose most of us would consider an archaic and untenable view, because all those relationships do not, with all the talk about gender-based violence, it's still prevalent in South Africa, and it's going to take a long time to change.
If I can just throw something in there, do you remember that one of his earlier more public scandals concerned his rape trial? Now, he was acquitted of that, and one is not questioning the wisdom of the judicial officers who were in court, as I was not. But I remember his defense there. Well, you can't leave a woman in that circumstance. And one wonders that if exiling people to Robben Island or whatever area where apparently he was familiar, that would apply to his own to his own indiscretions. One wonders.
Look,
But yeah,
let's put it this way. If you think about the fact that 99,000 schoolgirls have been impregnated, probably the vast majority would, in terms of statute, be considered to have been considered to have been underage rape, because it is underage intercourse, which is rape. Yep.
All right. We will close it there. And I hope that you found the show interesting. We will, of course, be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Wrap. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day.